G'day you mob, Pete here, and this is another episode of Aussie English, the number one place for anyone and everyone wanting to learn Australian English. So today I have a Goss episode for you where I sit down with my old man, my father, Ian Smisson, and we talk about the week's news, whether locally down under here in Australia or non-locally overseas in other parts of the world, okay? And we sometimes also talk about whatever comes to mind, right? If we can think of something interesting to share with you guys related to us or Australia, we also talk about that in the Goss. So these episodes are specifically designed to try and give you content about many different topics where we're obviously speaking in English and there are multiple people having a natural and spontaneous conversation in English. So it is particularly good to improve your listening skills. In order to complement that, though, I really recommend that you join the podcast membership or the academy membership at aussieenglish.com.au, where you will get access to the full transcripts of these episodes, the PDFs, the downloads, and you can also use the online PDF reader to read and listen at the same time. Okay, so if you really, really want to improve your listening skills fast, get the transcript, listen and read at the same time, keep practicing, and that is the quickest way to level up your English. Anyway, I've been rabbiting on a bit. I've been talking a bit. Let's just get into this episode, guys. Smack the bird, and let's get into it. Dad.
Pete.
What's the goss?
There's not a lot happening, really, apart from some lunatics in politics and the usual environmental disasters. Had the death of a famous Australian. But other than that, it's just business as usual.
You just haven't been looking hard enough.
Apparently not.
How's your week been? What's the goss in terms Busy. Of your goss?
My goss? Family history and photography, really. I've just spent most of my time still writing this family history, and I went up and visited my mum's cousin yesterday and had a good old chat with her about her family.
Sort of a chin wag.
Bit of a chin wag, bit of a goss. Yeah.
So, what do you have you sort of unturned any crazy rocks or stones and found any really big secrets since?
Not that I didn't already know about.
Yeah.
So, I think all the lunatics were already exposed.
Yeah. So, how's it going? And you want to talk about why you're writing this book too? I don't know if we've mentioned that.
No,
we probably have at some point.
We might have, just in passing. Look, I'm, yeah, as you know, my half-sister died last year. And look, I really didn't know her that well anyway, but
do you want to tell that story? Is that okay to tell?
Yeah, that's fine.
Because it's just a really interesting family history story.
It is.
Smisson family
the
history
Smisson
story.
Family history, which, yeah.
Sit down while we tell you a yarn.
Sit down, put your feet up, get a glass of beer and a red wine or whatever. So, hang on, I'll just spark up.
Knock this back.
So, my father, who married my mother in 1955, I was born in 57. He had already been married before. He was married 18 years before that, and he'd had a daughter at the end of the Second World War. He was in the Air Force during the Second World War.
Yep.
He had a daughter in 1945 and then separated from her mother when she was about 2 years old and was subsequently divorced, and then he came to Australia. And so-
And never saw her again.
And never saw her again, no. And she, in fact, didn't even know that her stepfather, because her mother remarried, didn't know that her stepfather was not her father until she was 11 years old. But we're sort of jumping ahead in that story a little bit, but-
It still blows my mind, though, every time you mention her age and when my grandfather, your father, left and just never to see her again.
I know.
And that's almost Noah's age.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that's almost, at least today, it's unfathomable.
Well, I think it's unfathomable regardless. I don't know what was going on in his head, but, you know,
that's- Yeah. Do you think it just gets easier with time, though, too? Like, it would have been painful to begin with.
I don't know. I don't know because- again, we're sort of jumping ahead to the end of the story, but and I'll wind back and come back to this one.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. When, because Dad died when I was 25.
1985, right?
Actually, just after I turned 26, 83.
Well, 83, yeah.
83, I just turned 26 4 days before. So, Mum died 20 years ago. And after Mum had died, we were obviously cleaning up her house and taking all of her you know, all the old papers and photographs and everything else. And I just boxed them up and stuck them in a box and put them in a cupboard in my study. And then a couple of years later, I was looking for some paperwork for, again, tracing up family history of my grandfather, my mother's mother's Navy record. Who forgot to turn off his phone? Yeah, penalty points.
I know.
You paid for the beers.
It's gone off everywhere. It's gone off on my computer.
Do you need to answer it? That's the question.
No, I don't think so.
No.
They tend to be scammers or spam.
Yeah, of course they are. Well, we could actually do a spam call live, couldn't we? Yeah.
Not now. I've just hung up and I'm going up onto airplane mode.
Right.
Sorry, guys. My bad.
Now, having said that...
Dad's going to remember to do it himself.
Mine's already on red. Good. We're off.
Cool.
Yeah, so looking for, you know, papers for my grandfather's Navy record, and I came across my father's divorce papers, which I had never seen before, and why he kept them, I have no idea, but they were just in this box of stuff.
So you didn't find that out until after Grad died.
I knew he'd already been married, and I knew he'd had a daughter, but I found his divorce papers and then got the name of the child because we never even knew the name. Just knew that there was a daughter. When I was younger, I probably didn't ask. So once I found her name, then I decided that I would try and find it. And this was in 2001. And so, you know, to cut a long story short, it took a lot of chasing around to find her because she had been married twice. And the second marriage was in France. And French marriage records are generally not publicly available. And I don't speak enough French to be able to find them anyway. I probably could have, but I probably speak enough to have, you know, dragged my way through it if I'd known, but I didn't. So, long story short, I eventually did find her using a professional people finder in the UK. Because she was living in England at the time, which we had assumed. And that was the fact that she was living there was the only chance that we had of finding her. If she'd migrated somewhere, there's no immigration records from Britain. There's only immigration records. So they only care about who's coming in, not who's leaving. I just rang her. Once I got her address and phone number, I rang her. And, you know, that's an interesting conversation with someone where you start with, is your name and was your father's name.
And they're like, because, is this spam? Who is this? Exactly. Why are you calling? How did you get this number?
It's an interesting scam call when you're ringing saying, I think I'm your brother. And of course, that was 20 years ago now.
And she had no idea, right?
She had no idea. I knew she existed. She had no idea because, Dad had left when she was two.
And there was no connection to anything that he ever did.
Nothing. So, she had sort of assumed that he probably got married again, might have had children, but she didn't know anything.
Yeah.
So, as she said, all of a sudden, she'd been an only child because her mother and stepfather didn't have any more children. She'd been an only child for her entire life. And then, in a 20-minute phone call, she's now got
three siblings.
Three siblings scattered around the world. So, that was interesting. And then I, visited her several times and we, telephone calls and emails and so on. So, she died, unfortunately, last year. That wasn't the trigger to it, but it was more a few years ago I decided that because I don't even own one grandfather. My father's parents, I didn't know, they were in Britain and he didn't speak to them. After he had left Britain, he never contacted them again. My mother's mother died when I was less than 2 years old. And
your mother's father, you knew?
My mother's father, he lived with us. So, I knew him very well, but I didn't know anything else. So, everything else I've had to find by, digging up documents and talking to people who knew them and, those sort of things. So, I decided now that I've got grandchildren that I really should write, and this is really, the book's now 100,000 words. It'll be cut, but it'll it was really an extended letter to my grandchildren, and I've just started writing the introduction and opening it with these are the answers to the questions I would have liked to ask the three grandparents that I never knew.
Yeah.
And so, that was the reason for doing it is really just – having done 30 years of family history research, and it's all sitting in a database somewhere, but nobody's ever going to trawl through that.
You've got to condense it down. You've got to make it bite-sized.
Bite-sized. 100,000 words.
It's got to be palatable. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you've just got to have the chapters in there written, you know, just named after the people you want to read them. So, Pete, you.
Read this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'll just skim it.
Yeah. So, and it's an interesting challenge to structure a book like that because, obviously-
mm-hmm. I come first. Right?
No. You get a mention right near the end. Yeah. Because it's-
Still going, too, to be continued.
Exactly, to be continued. Exactly. So, the family ancestry is obviously hierarchical. So, the further you go back, the more ancestors you have.
You'd hope so.
Yeah, exactly. So, and
otherwise, it means you're probably pretty inbred, right?
Exactly right. And so, yeah, there's it's an interesting sort of challenge to try and write a book that you can't write as a linear chronology. Yeah. You have to write it as a series of cascading chronologies. So, I've really tried to look at it and say, you know, the four key people are my grandparents, and they're the ones that I can write a fair amount about,
yeah.
either by first-hand knowledge or by, you know, the information that I've got, but then to cascade their families down in through them. So, and then you get to great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents and so on. And so, every time you start with a name, and obviously, I start with my Smithson ancestry.
Yeah.
So, I start with my four times great-grandfather, George Smithson or Smithson or Smithson, depending on which document you believe.
Yeah. Do you, to pause you there, do you think our name originally was Smithson?
Smithson. Yeah. Well, his name was
someone
Smithson.
Someone misheard it.
Yeah.
Wrote down it as Smithson or Smithson.
And Smithson, Smithson. So,
yeah.
Yeah. And look, even the spelling of the name is weird because my grandfather spelled his name as we do, with the E-N on the end. Mm. And his brother, his older brother, spelt it with O-N. On the end, and they were both literate. They were both ministers in the Congregational Church, which, to qualify for that at the time, was the equivalent of a university qualification. So, they were quite literate. It wasn't that they just made up a spelling, and yet they spelled it that way. So, I've got second cousins whose surname is spelled differently.
Yeah, and that's weird.
Yeah, so, it's a bit weird. Yeah, so that was really the idea of just documenting all of the research that I've been doing, but also not just the, you know, who was born when and stuff, which most of the, mm-hmm. you know, the great greats and so on, that's all I know about them. But there are two other layers. There's the people that I know about and I can write about. And because you never knew your grandfather, my father.
And that's the stuff that's sort of the most precious stuff that could be lost, right?
Yeah. If I die, you no longer have got it other than my sisters. You've got no ability to find out anything about those people.
But that's never going to be what you would have had inside you, right? At the same way that it's not what they have, but it's going to be a subjective kind of experience that you had with those people that is lost.
And the whole, the writing is all in the first person because it's either about me or it's about the memories I have or the research I've done to get to these things. So,
I always feel so sort of nostalgic about something that I was never there to experience when I learn about ancestors or even just think about, you know, people in the past in Australia, doing a lot of the research or reading about Australian settlers and squatters and, you know, colonists and convicts and indigenous people. It makes you think a lot about what it was like living in those times.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you do kind of, you know, I think it's probably just the experience of being alive, concern yourself with what's going on around you in a day-to-day kind of environment and get lost in the, well, this is how it's always been, you know, and this is what it's current. Like, everyone alive today is what's always been here because it's my current experience. But you forget that there's been waves and waves of, you know, many more people that have lived entire lives in the past than have ever lived. Yeah. I mean, that are alive today.
Yeah.
And so,
I think it's about the same number now.
Wasn't it 100 billion that have lived in the past, that have lived and died?
Yeah, I think since in historical times.
Yeah.
In terms of, the last couple of thousand years when, history goes back further than that, documented, but basically the last 2,000 years, we've got documented evidence of things. Then there have been about 7 billion people who have died in that time and there are about 7 billion people alive. Which in itself is weird. Yeah.
I mean, even today, I was sitting at Eastern Beach waiting for Kel while she was in the hospital getting a checkup. And I was just sitting at this beach and I was just thinking, you know, how long has this been a beach like it is today? Because, you know, the protected sort of semicircle ring there that you can go swimming in has been built. I think it was built in the early 1900s, in the 30s or something.
1930s, I believe.
Yeah, because some woman was bitten by a shark and lost her arm, I think.
Yeah.
So, they built this for safe swimming. But I was thinking, you know, for how many tens of thousands of years before that were the indigenous people here looking at the Yuyang Mountains across this bay
Yeah.
And just strolling along
this
beach.
And the bay, of course, is quite recent.
Yeah.
Because the bay-
Geelong Bay.
Yeah. Well, Corio Bay in Geelong. Because, you know, a few thousand years ago, it, you know, Port Phillip Bay and Corio Bay didn't exist.
They would have just been river grass, flats, right?
Yeah. Grassland. And Corio Bay is actually, it's bizarre. It would have been, it's a deep harbour.
Yeah.
But it has a shell grit and sand bar across it that we, even today, we still have to keep dredging. And so I suspect there were periods of time when that sandbar got, you know, built up enough that it was above the high tide mark.
Mm.
And so that you would have had this sort of giant lagoon and it doesn't have a river running into it because you'd think the Barwon River would run into it. The Barwon River gets within about 200 metres of it,
but then
goes in the other direction. So, because there's sort of, you know, higher, you know, land that Geelong is built on.
Well, and it's a funny situation because I think we have the indigenous names Geelong, which I think was Geelong. And Corio.
Geelong, I think. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And originally, though, I think when it got misinterpreted as Corio Bay, Corio was actually the location.
Allegedly.
And Geelong was the bay.
Yeah. When Hume and Hovell, who were the explorers from what was the growing Sydney in the 1820s, were probably not the first white people there because- you know, we've told the story of the
Buckley.
Famous Australian William Buckley, who escaped from an 1803 settlement on the other side of the bay and then ended up in Geelong.
Went the whole way around.
Eventually went the whole way around. And I'm sure there are other Europeans who had been there. Matthew Flinders was there before them and so on. But Hume and Hovell were the ones who looked for finding effectively an inland pathway through from the, you know, crossed, well, the Blue Mountains had already been crossed, but from the inside, you know, land areas in New South Wales down into what is now Victoria. And they arrived in what we now call Geelong. And the story goes, whether it is apocryphal or not, it probably doesn't matter because it's a good story in that, you know, they've called Corio Bay the water. And allegedly, Corio was the local indigenous word for the area. And Geelong was the local indigenous word for
the body
of water there. Now, I've heard that several times.
So have I.
Whether it is true or not, who knows?
It's a good story.
It's a good story. But anyway, both Corio and Geelong are unique place names in the world because they were named after the words that the local indigenous people used for that area, whether it be water or land. So,
is it Hume and Hovell where- I think it was Hovell's one of the most disagreeable characters, right?
One of them was, whichever one of them was, apparently a bastard, and the other one hated him.
Yeah, I think they ended up having a fight over a fry pan or something, didn't they? And then one of them ends up bailing, just being like, "Screw you guys,
see,
I'm
going back to Sydney.
You stuff can this.
Get back.
Keep your fry pan." But coming back to your story.
So my story. Look, the other thing that I was really interested in is obviously all non-Indigenous Australians are products of relatively recent migration. And so, every generation except for one in my family has a migrant coming to Australia. And, you know-
Which generation doesn't?
All my grandparents were born in Australia. My two grandparents that are Australian were born in Australia.
Yes. The other two
never came to Australia. So, that's
they
the only
born
generation
in Australia,
that
they just never came here.
Yeah. Every other generation has- because my father was a migrant to Australia.
Yes.
And great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, all the way back four great-great-grandparents goes back to there. So, you know, they're just interesting migration stories in these sort of generational things from the mid-19th century up to the mid-20th century. We've got these sort of every 20 to 30 years with that gap of the grandparents' era, every 20 to 30 years, another person or a group of people came to Australia. And so, there are interesting stories to tell about where they came from, why they wanted to migrate to Australia, what life was like. There were several of them that came in the mid-19th century and took up, they were early settlers in various places around Victoria. And so, they're interesting stories to look at as to, why people moved out there, how the government opened up land, and we haven't spoken about the, you know, the squatter, you know, movement as it was.
The book up there by, is it Barry Stone, The Squatters? Yeah. I've got to get to it at some point.
Because they were basically people who just said, well, we're going to go out and, you know, farm this land, and they just went out and created it. And the government was perfectly happy to, because they were clearing the land and they were creating little settlements
and the government could always reserve the right to just take the land back.
And they did. Well, in most cases, they didn't take it all, but they basically just took parts of it and then-
Thanks for all that work.
And sold it off under these sort of settler agreements, because they went from squatters to settlers, and the settlers were different because they had to apply for the land, and they had to they purchased it usually on lease agreements, and those lease agreements were either 3 years, 5 years, or 10 years, mostly 10, but often the 10s was 3 plus 7, and in the first 3 years, there was a minimum amount of land and a maximum amount of land that they could get. And they had to improve that land. They either had to live on it or keep stock on it.
They had to be using it. You couldn't just be like, everything the eye sees, Simba, is yours.
Yeah. And then you just bugger off back to Melbourne and live in your little house in Carlton. And so those people then paid a lease on it. But after 10 years, the lease was effectively paying off the land. So, they were given it after that. The right to buy it if they still owed lease money.
So, those were the good old days where Australians could afford to buy land and property.
Yeah, well, not all could. And look, funnily, I was actually talking to a second cousin once removed. He was actually he would have been my mother's second cousin, who still lives on the land that his great-great-grandfather settled.
Really?
Yeah. Who was the son of my great-great-great-great-grandfather.
That must be pretty rare outside of farmers, I would imagine.
He's in his 80s. Wow. And his son has a property across the road. And he said he came back onto the land and decided- And the two of them, his wife died 10 years ago, but the two of them, he and his son, farm these 5,000 acres of land by themselves.
Yeah.
And
is it sheep?
No, it's mostly cropping. Okay. So, you know, you know, wheat and, you know, barley and oats and so on. But, and I mean, they've had mixed farms in that area for a while. I don't think he has sheep now, but some people have had sheep. But it's pretty borderline country for sheep. But they, you know, they grow crops on it. And so he's now concerned that other than the one son who's done that, he said, you know, when he leaves his, you know, land, either retires or dies, it'll be too much for his son to take on, you know, the two properties. And he said, I don't know what's going to happen to it, because it's unlikely that his other children or grandchildren are going to want to come back and farm that land.
Bought by someone else.
Yeah.
Which is what's happened to every other one of your ancestors.
I know. Well, exactly. And so, yeah, some of them have had, they started off with small allotments and they just kept buying more land.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as they could afford it, they bought more land and expanded. And
there were a few of those stories coming up recently, I think, especially after the bushfires. And I think, was it 2018 or 19 where we had really bad crop yields?
Yes.
And there were quite a few examples, I think I saw in the news, of farmers being like fifth or sixth generation on that same farm and then having to sell up. And that it was like, you know, the end of an era, effectively, that you have all of these lineages of the original people who were given the land, the families there, obviously to not talk about the indigenous people that owned it before, but that they had sort of had this unbroken thing for hundreds of years, and then it's just some other, you know, Chinese company or some Rio Tinto buys
that's
it.
That's the problem with a lot of those, you know, families, is that they're not being bought up by another farming family.
No.
They're being bought up by multinational farming corporations who just put a manager in there and-
Yeah.
You know, and in fact, that's ironically a cheaper and more efficient way to manage that land because you only need, you know, one header, you know, the, you know, harvester for a lot of those things for 100,000 acres, but nobody owns 100,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And so, everybody has their own million-dollar piece of machinery that they use for 1 month a year. And,
So, what were some of the reasons that your ancestors came out to Australia? Did it tend to be the same sort of story repeated again and again and again, that it was sort of an economic reason, or was there a whole bunch of different
reasons? There's a bunch of different reasons. I think the ones who came out here in that mid-19th century, certainly the ones who came from Scotland and Ireland, particularly Ireland in the 1840s was the famous potato famine.
Yeah.
And most Irish peasants and farmers were cropping potatoes, and that was their not only to sell, but that was their, you know, main food source as well. And, you know, 80 to 90% of the potato crops for about 8 years in Ireland failed because of a fungal disease. And
I think they lost a million people.
Yeah.
A million people died, and I think more than that-
another million left.
Ended up migrating.
So, a lot of them went to North America and to Australia and, you know, South Africa and places like that. So, so there are a few of those. The ones in Scotland, I think it was mostly that, 100 years after the Brits had effectively just broken down the clan system in Scotland, that it just was no longer profitable to be a croft farmer, you know, a small farmer on a small amount of land. And so they just left and came to Australia. Others were just more opportunistic, great-great-grandparents who arrived in 1853.
This was prior to the gold rush, or about
a year and a half after the gold rush started. 51, so 52. It was in the peak of the gold rush, and they clearly came to Australia with the opportunity, you know, just an opportunity to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And others did go gold mining, but made enough money to buy something, and they bought land and went farming. James and Jane Sprake came out here, and James was a bricklayer and stonemason, and they're actually two quite different trades, but he did bits of both along the way. He built a couple of chimneys when he first arrived in Geelong, made enough money to buy two horses and a cart, and then he took up carting goods from Geelong to Ballarat for the gold rush. So
it's pretty screwed up if you think about the fact that he built a few chimneys, and that gave him enough money to buy the equivalent of probably what is today multiple cars.
Yeah.
Or a car. Yeah. I can't imagine being paid to make two or three chimneys.
Yeah, $30,000 to build two chimneys. Yeah.
But I guess you forget that back in the day when you had these houses that were very rudimentary and usually centered around a chimney.
The first thing built.
You cooked, it was your heat source, and it was the strongest part of the house.
It's the last thing standing when the rest of the house falls down.
So, it is something you'll see, right, when you drive around the country here. Quite often, there's
stone chimneys.
You'll see stone chimneys left over or the ruins. But bringing it back to your dad, do you want to talk a little bit about his reason for coming out and sort of the interesting history about what you potentially think is the reason?
Yeah, well, you know, as we've said, he divorced his wife and left her and the child and his child in the late 1940s, and he came to Australia in 1950. And I suspect it was just, I'm going to, you know, completely new change. He changed his name, didn't change his surname, funnily enough, changed his first name and his middle name, which, again, is a bit bizarre. You're going to think if you're going to, you know, turn over a new leaf, as they say, and you change your life, and you've got an unusual surname, you would change it. But he didn't.
Because how many Smithsons are there in Australia? There's probably,
Handful? There are two families. There's one based out of Adelaide, which has now moved all over the place, and there's us.
Yeah.
And so, he came to Australia, and because he'd been in the RAF, the Air Force in Britain, during the war up until 1946, asked to join the RAAF, the Australian Air Force.
Yep.
And he was an officer in the RAF, but he came out here as a sergeant, so, you know, senior non-commissioned person in the RAAF, and was just basically in administration, office work. And he left that after about a year and did some other work here and there. And then there's a gap of about a year where I've got no records of what he was doing. He says he was labouring and cane cutting and things in Queensland, and I have no reason to not believe that, but I've got no evidence for it either. And then in 1955, for whatever reason, I never asked him. In hindsight, you always think you should, but I never asked him. And he went, decided he was going back to England. And at the same time, my mother, who was then a 23-year-old single woman, and she was going to England to go on a holiday in Europe with some friends. And they met on the ship and got married almost as soon as they got to Britain. And here I am.
Still running on DSLR cameras that can't handle more than 29 minutes of video. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, they can handle it. They're just not allowed to.
Do you want to get into what your potential hypothesis is for why he left Britain? Is that okay to talk about, or you don't want to talk about that?
Oh, no. Well, I just think he didn't like his parents. He didn't speak to them. He did have a brother and a sister, and he got on reasonably well with them. But at the same time, they were looking to move away from Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And they both ended up in Africa. I just think he was, you know, literally write off your life and start again.
But with the reason for his marriage to break down, or is that something that you don't want to touch
well, on? Look, you know, he'd had, you know, he was divorced based on, you know, but that was, you know, his divorce was a year and a bit before he left to come to Australia. But, yeah, it, allegedly, well, according to his divorce papers, he'd had an affair with a woman.
Yeah.
So, his wife sued him for divorce and- Her husband, the woman he'd been having the affair with, her husband sued for divorce on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later, they were married.
The people who had both sued their partners for divorce, right?
Yes.
Were the ones who then got married to one another.
Mm.
And so, this was one of those things. This is what I wanted to get to because I always thought this is such a fascinating-
It is. And it's a fascinating story because we're never going to know the answer.
Yeah. There's got to be something more to this.
And unfortunately, my sister, who I'd never talked to about it, it's one of those sensitive ones of either she knew and she didn't want to talk about it or she probably didn't know because I'm sure her parents wouldn't have told her.
Yeah.
And I didn't necessarily want to throw that- that fuel into the fire and go, oh, and guess what?
Now that you're on your way out.
Yeah.
I've got some important questions.
So she would have been, if anybody knew, she would have been the one who knew. But look, it's obviously there are only two alternatives. Mm. Either they were also having an affair
or
they were the only ones having an affair and there was a whole lot of other stuff going on. Or they, after their two divorces, they just ended up getting together.
Yeah, we've got so much in common.
Both of those are equally likely, and they're both interesting stories.
Mm.
So,
yeah, it is. It is one of those things, though. I think that it's sad that you'll never know for sure.
No,
right?
No, there's a lot of writing this book, there's more than half of it is speculation.
Yeah,
speculation based on a bit of evidence and a bit of knowledge, but then I honestly don't know why this happened.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a gap. There's all sorts of gaps and mysteries. And you sit there and go, I can guess.
Here's some of the alternatives.
If I had this bit of this document,
then
and sometimes you get the document and it just adds to the confusion.
Mm.
Yeah. But that's part of the interesting part of families as well, is that, if I knew everything, then it'd be boring.
For the people listening, do you think that every single person is going to have an interesting family history one way or another?
Of course they are.
Because it goes out exponentially and keeps encompassing different people.
And look, most people are inherently interesting. They have some parts of their lives that are interesting. Whether we know about that or not is a different story. But certainly my grandfather was interesting in a whole lot of ways. And we'll probably save that one up for another episode. Okay. My other three grandparents were equally interesting, but I didn't know them, so I didn't know anything firsthand. Just but even when you dig into, go back four or five generations and you find things about people and you go, oh, this person must have been motivated by a whole lot of these things that you can start to assume based on their behavior and what they did and
where they went,
directions that they took and the decisions they made in life. And those things, I think, are just inherently interesting.
Yeah. So, for those listening, if they were interested in trying to go down the route of family history, obviously, it's a bit of a difficult one to answer so broadly because we're going to have people from all over the world.
Exactly.
How would you suggest that, John Doe listening to this starts that journey if they're starting from zero?
Look, the classic sort of genealogist first step that every professional genealogist will tell you is, go and talk to the people who are still alive.
Yep.
Talk to your parents, talk to your grandparents, talk to your cousins, your brothers, your sisters, your aunts, your uncles, your neighbors, anybody who can give you a bit of information because they're the leads that you're going to get. Yes, you can go and look up, birth certificates and death certificates and marriage certificates and, there's all sorts of other documents that people leave around. But depending on which country you come from, they're not as necessarily easy to find.
And they're not necessarily stories too, right?
Yeah, they're just leads into stories. But
this happened at this place between these people.
But you'll be surprised how many people don't know anything about their grandparents if they've never met them, particularly people who have migrated.
Yeah.
Or who are first generation Australians, like you know, I am on yeah. one half. The reason I know very little about my father's parents is because I never met them.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and I never met them because my father left Britain and came to Australia. And so-
And probably wasn't in a sort of situation to want to-
And he didn't particularly want to talk about them because yeah. he- One of the reasons I'm sure he left is
Nor
he didn't
have you
like
them.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think that's the key to it is just find out those stories from the people who are living. And then you'll end up with keys and go, oh- You mean my, you know, great-grandfather served in the war? Well, I can go and check war records.
Yeah.
Or he had this job. Oh, what do I know about that job? You might not know exactly what your grandfather, great-grandfather, your great-grandmother, your great-grandmother might have been the first doctor in Prague,
yeah.
you know, for all you know. And then you can go, oh, I can find out about something. What was it like being a female doctor in Europe in yeah. you know, the early 19th century or 20th century or whatever?
I was going to say, I imagine that you could find out, you know, that say in the case of some, I think it's, is it mum's ancestors or yours that were scissor putterer together?
That's one of your, yeah, scissor putterer. The greatest job title ever, a scissor putter togetherer.
Yeah, so they
put
literally
it together
got the two halves.
Not a word, but
they got the two halves of the scissors and they put them together for their entire life.
And that's it's actually a very highly skilled job because particularly when, and even when I was a kid, we had one pair, other than my
Back
mother,
when they made
my mother
things
had
to
sewing
last.
Scissors. Yeah. We had one pair of general scissors in the house my entire childhood.
Well,
and they're expensive. Mm-hmm. And when they went blunt, you took them off to the hardware store who sent them off to a specialist scissor sharpener. And scissor sharpening was different from knife sharpening because the two blades have to cross over in order to cut and so on. So, actually building, and these were people in Sheffield in England where the center of the steel industry in the 19th century. And so, putting scissors together was a fairly skilled job. You needed to be pretty good at it
so
because
to be
people
adjusted,
paid a
right?
lot of
you,
yeah.
It's not just putting
it's not
A
just,
and B together.
Yeah, not just snap them together. Yeah. It was you were adjusting them and lining them up and potentially sharpening them and doing all that sort of stuff. So, there are jobs like that. You just sit there and go, "That's a thing." Like, yeah.
Have you seen those Japanese scissors that are like thousands of dollars? But it's 100%. It would be the kind of scissors that you would buy one pair of forever.
Yeah, your great-great-grandchildren are still going to be using them.
Made
from samurai swords.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. But, yeah, it blows my mind to sort of, you know, hopefully not draw this episode out too much, but it's sort of like digging up treasure, right?
It is.
Because I see that with Kel. She knows next to zero about her family's history besides the people who are still alive or the people that she's had personal interactions with. Mm. And all she knows really is the what's come from the personal interactions, not really what's deeper than that.
Yeah.
You know, like what did her grandparents do as children or where do they, where did their parents come from?
You can, I don't know. I'm not specifically talking about Kel here, but you can almost guarantee that in most families, people will know a lot more than they're telling you.
Yeah,
and they're 100%. Not necessarily keeping the secrets.
They just don't think you're interested.
They don't get asked. You know, I'm never going to sit down with you when you're a kid and say, you know, when my dad was little, he used to do this. And, yeah, well, I don't care. You know, but they're the sort of things that are interesting once you start to think about.
Sit down and listen to my damn stories.
Exactly.
But Kel's blows my mind because she did the DNA test, which is probably another piece of advice for you guys if you have the money and you can be bothered spending it on, you know, getting your DNA run.
It's a bit esoteric, but it's fun.
Well, she got joined up. Once she did it, she was joined up with a bunch of fifth and sixth cousins. So, it was kind of like a starting point. Once there's a sort of threshold.
So, that's already happened. She's now got those connections.
Well, I don't know if she actually followed them up.
No, but at least you know who they are.
When we were on, I think it was Ancestry.com. It was like there was a ton of Brazilians that had done this. And she was, you know, there was like 20 or 30 people on there that were like, this person's a relative.
Yeah.
Which, you know, well, everyone is, but.
Yes.
But when
a documented relative with.
Yeah. Well, when she got her DNA results back about, you know, which regions on Earth you're from, because we were sort of putting bets in.
She was from all of them.
She keeps getting asked, are you Asian? You know, do you have Asian heritage? You know, you look like you're half Chinese, half Anglo-Saxon or something. Mm. And she's always like, no, I'm Brazilian, at least not as far as I know. And I was like, well, do you know? So, she went and did the test and found out she had like-
The only bits she didn't have were Asian.
Well, that's it. Yeah, pretty much an indigenous Australian. She was from, you know, mostly Portuguese, then Spanish, and then I think it was like French, English, Scottish, Irish.
Yeah, so that's the European
part. Then she had this big chunk that was indigenous
American.
South American.
Yeah.
And there were five different West African countries that she had DNA. It was like, you know, 15% of her DNA was from West Africa.
Yeah.
And I was like, so clearly, if you dig back into your history, you're going to have at least
five ancestors
that have come from Africa there.
Great grandparents somewhere.
And then you're going to have a whole bunch of indigenous ancestors. Like, yeah. And how interesting are those stories going to be to dig up?
Yeah, but they'll be really hard to dig up. Of course, the indigenous ones, yeah. There's no documentation. But
yeah,
you can dig through those things. And you know, in the end, the really interesting part is that it's a never-ending jigsaw. It's like most people who do jigsaw puzzles, they start doing the outside and then fill it in.
Yeah.
With genealogy and family history, you start in the middle and you just keep expanding and there's never an edge. Yeah, because there is always, you know, obviously, the last person on the list has parents.
Yeah.
Whether you can find out who they were, and unless, and certainly in Europe, unless you are related to royalty or the aristocracy, then records really, in Britain, they really only started, the Church of England kept records from the mid-16th century. Because they wanted to distinguish themselves from the Catholics who didn't keep records of, you know, births, deaths and marriages. And the civil registration didn't start in Britain until 1837. And other European countries were around the same sort of time. But it just means that unless you're in the, you know, an aristocrat or a royalty, nobody bothered keeping records before then.
Mm.
But if you do, like you, you've got royal blood.
Oh,
you're related to you know, every you know, king and queen of Europe, you know, basically.
That means a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Show me the castles.
What's my inheritance?
Yeah.
You get one third of a dollar.
Yeah, you get a third of a brick from some castle in Bavaria. But yeah, even then you find that out, and that's just cool. You go, yeah. I mean,
you know, it does give you a bit more of an attachment. So now that I think of people like Alfred the Great, or whatever,
you're related. Like, you're a direct descendant of Alfred
Rollo,
the Great,
right? Rollo the Viking.
Yeah,
that's crazy. And was it
Charlemagne?
Richard the Conqueror. Yeah. Is it him too? Charlemagne. Yeah,
William the Conqueror.
William
Charlemagne.
The Conqueror. Yeah, that's crazy. Well, it's crazy when you read those stories, and you do have that sort of direct contact.
Yeah.
With them. The last question that I had was, and I don't know if it was your side of the family or mum's, but I remember one of you talking about having family members who burnt a lot of the photos and records.
I think both of us have had that.
Why was that a behavior that your ancestors did where they just burned all of the photos
and
records?
The specific one was your mother's grandmother.
Yeah. Or mother's mother, right? My grandmother's mother.
Grandmother's mother. Yeah. No, your grandfather's mother.
Okay.
I think when her husband died, she just went, I'm just going to clean stuff out. And she wasn't interested in it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, look, my mother had a very similar attitude. She didn't throw photographs away. She actually liked photographs and things. But her attitude to anything else was, if I'm not using it, I'm going to throw it out.
Yeah, minimalist.
So, I lost a whole lot of my childhood toys and things.
Matchbox cars. So,
matchbox cars. I'll tell you the matchbox cars story one day. That were, you know, obviously of personal value to me, but are actually quite valuable. I probably had $10,000 in, you know, worth of matchbox toys in today's value. Because they were all pretty good condition and they're all in their original boxes and, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But mum just looked at them and went, oh, and, you know, Ian doesn't play with these anymore. Don't ask Ian. Just throw them out. So I think that's the other reason. If you start to talk to parents and grandparents and other relatives about things, then they will dig stuff up and you go,
don't burn this.
Don't burn it. Don't throw it away. And the beauty now,
keep that away from the fire.
The beauty now in sort of, you know, in with modern, you know, digital technology is that you don't have to worry about keeping granny's photograph album. Just ask granny if you can scan it.
Yeah.
Or at the worst, go and sit down with granny and get your phone out and go, you know,
bang,
just
bang,
take
bang.
So at least you've got a record. And the best thing to do is ask granny at the time. So, who was this? Oh, that's my aunt from blah, blah, blah. And she migrated here from Russia in the middle
jog
of the 18th
memory.
Century.
Jog her memory.
And, yeah, blah, blah. So, you can actually do that stuff. Whereas, if you just get a whole lot of photographs, yeah, I've got hundreds of my mother's photographs.
And you don't know who.
And I just sit there and go, I can recognize most of her relatives that I knew.
Yeah.
And a few of the people that she told me who they were. I'm sure the others were just family, friends and things, but I don't know. So,
I wonder how long until Ancestry gets a setup where you can just upload photos and they do facial recognition.
Facial recognition already exists for those things. Yeah. But, yeah. And look, Ancestry or one of those other things will do it. I know the Church of Latter-day Saints has been talking about doing it because they have a- their version of Ancestry is basically saying we are going to join up the world. So, we're going to make sure every person's ancestry is documented and that'll be the next step of just saying, well, you know, upload your photographs. Somebody else will have uploaded one with somebody's name on it. Of course, it doesn't mean that that person was right.
Yeah.
And that's the big challenge when you're starting to look at secondary or tertiary information in genealogy is that you're relying on how clever, accurate, and conservative the person was who put it up. Whereas many people go, oh, I'm related to William the Conqueror. You actually are, and it's well documented. But many people go, my grandfather said I was, therefore that's the answer. And so you end up, and people start putting in family trees and links to other family trees.
It's a big mess.
And then it just, and then 15 other people copy them, and then it becomes the sort of accepted truth when there is actually no documentary evidence for half of it. So
I can't imagine the people who did this for a living. I'd be like, just pay someone else to do it. I would never want to do this. It'd be such a headache.
Yeah. But it's fun.
Yeah.
It's
a problem solving.
Yeah, it's problem solving. It's a multi-dimensional jigsaw puzzle, and it's an intellectual one, not a visual one.
Through time and space.
Exactly. Exactly right.
All right. Well, that's probably a good place to leave it.
That was a lot longer than we thought we were going to do.
45 minutes. Yeah. You did well. You did well. Anything to end on, Dad? Any other points? Just get out there and start learning about your heritage.
Get out there and do it. Yeah. Ask your parents. Ask your grandparents.
Man, share your interesting stories with us. Send me an email if you do some digging and find something interesting.
And you know what? The best thing about it is- they will enjoy talking about it. They'll enjoy being asked. Or they'll say, no, piss off. I don't want to talk about that.
And you'll be like, ooh.
That in itself is even more interesting. So, Nana, why don't you want to talk about your mother and the fact that she was a single mother and you know, blah, blah, blah.
And that had a good aversion to milkmen.
Don't mention the milkman.
All right. See you guys.
Bye. Enjoy.
Alrighty, you mob, thank you so much for listening to or watching this episode of The Goss. If you would like to watch the video, if you're currently listening to it and not watching it, you can do so on the Aussie English channel on YouTube. You'll be able to subscribe to that. Just search Aussie English on YouTube. And if you're watching this and not listening to it, you can check this episode out also on the Aussie English podcast, which you can find via my free Aussie English podcast application on both Android and iPhone. You can download that for free, or you can find it via any other good podcast app that you've got on your phone, Spotify, podcasts from iTunes, Stitcher, whatever it is. I'm your host, Pete. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you have a ripper of a day, and I will see you next time. Peace.